Well, welcome back, everybody, to Liberty Freelance. I am your host, Phil Lindemann. And yes, I changed the name of the podcast because I can do that. This is the brave new world of the internet, and you can change the name of your podcast if you can. This title was a bit long, and in any case, it's becoming abundantly clear from the initiation of this podcast that the topic that I am discussing with you every Tuesday is much broader than just freelance medical editing and writing, although that's where I got my start in this business. Really, the wave of the future, and I don't mean the future, I mean the immediate future, as in today, August 25th, 2020, is going to be increasingly atomized, dispersed freelance work. And if you're already making your living this way, great, you're sitting in the proverbial catbird seat. If you're not, I want to give you some reasons to consider getting into it. And the first way to do this would be to go to libertyfreelance.com, which conveniently is the name of a website where you can post a profile, where you can showcase your skills that you can offer to the world. Right now, this is generally in the science, technology, and medicine space, or STEM space, but will be expanding into much broader categories. If that means starting new sites, so be it. And this I'll be getting into in a bit more philosophical detail. I want to tell you also about our week in Nantucket. Josie and I just got back. A new, what I hope will be a segment. I got a question from one of my contacts. I'll tell you about her question, and it leads into the to what I think is a very reasonable, important question about what is medical communications. It's a great question with no simple. And by the way, folks who know me and folks who know me when I was practicing medicine know that every time I preface an answer by saying, that's a great question, you know I'm going to love giving the answer. Okay? That's a clue. And then I want, if we have, especially if we have time, I'm going to talk about a blog post I ran into, which introduces a concept called collaborative independent review. And I'd want to tell you all about that stuff, but first, I want to tell you about this. So it seems that a Mr. Smith was shipwrecked. Now, shipwrecks happen. Not everybody is lucky as Mr. Smith to crawl himself to a swim himself to a desert island and to haul himself ashore. And Mr. Smith is an industrious kind of guy. Not without talents in construction. And over the course of years, he builds himself structures on this island. He's there for years, though. And one day, as often happens in stories just like this, a ship appears on the horizon. And he jumps up and down on the beach, and he waves his hands, and he yells, and he hoots and hollers. He doesn't need to. This is the 21st century. The ship knows he's there, right? And they approach. They throw their anchor off, and a boat is lowered. And the captain of the ship rows himself to shore. Or, because this is the 21st century, perhaps he motors himself to shore. It doesn't matter. And when he gets there, Mr. Smith is so happy to see the captain, he offers to give him a tour of the island. Okay, so they're on the island, and it seems that Mr. Smith has built two magnificent structures. And he's excited to show these to the captain. And he shows the captain the first structure. And the captain says, well, this is really beautiful. I mean, congratulations, terrific work. What is it? He said, well, Captain, this is my church. It's my house of worship. It's where I go to pray. Oh, I said, wow, that is really terrific. But he notices that there is another structure that the man has already built. And he says, and this one over here? And Smith says, oh, that church? I wouldn't set foot in there. And now we come to the segment called No Joke is Made Funnier by Explaining It. But I'm going to have to explain it. Now, this joke is told in many contexts. I understand there's a Welsh version of the joke. There is certainly a Jewish version of the joke. That's where I first learned it. And it has to do with an aspect of human nature, which is, I'm afraid, very deep in our DNA and maybe difficult or impossible to extract. But I want to explain it. And I think by explaining it, exposing it to the light, we may be able to begin to combat this aspect of human nature. And that is that we have a tendency to define ourselves not only by who we are, but by who we are not. And in the Welsh version of this joke, the man has built an entire community, including two churches, one of which he goes to and one of which he doesn't. In the Jewish version, there are only two structures, one synagogue that the man goes to and one that he wouldn't set foot in. And what is this aspect of human nature? It is a tendency to define ourselves by who we are, but also by who we are not, us and them. Now, what is the sort of genetic basis of this? I think the reason why we as a species, and all of the species on Earth for that matter, have survived lo these many millennia, or if you prefer the narrative, why we were created the way we were, was because separating ourselves into two groups, us and them, and by the way, there is a terrific song by, I better get this right, Pink Floyd, called Us and Them, which analyzes this problem from a musical standpoint. This separation of the world into us and them has been adaptive, all right? It has enhanced our survival by identifying oneself with their in-group and the others as out-group, because the in-group is likely to protect you and enhance your survival, and the out-group is out to kill you, okay? All right, so we have identified, we have either been created with or we have evolved this capacity in order to advance our survival. However, in the modern 21st century world, in which human beings have no natural predators anymore, and in which there is no a priori reason why other human beings should be our enemies. In fact, to the contrary, collaborating with, cooperating with our enemies, with our former enemies, is really only redounds to our mutual benefit. This character trait, this element of our human nature, which had been adaptive in the past, is now maladaptive. In other words, division makes us more poorer. It makes us distracted, and in many cases, God help us, it kills us. I watched a documentary last night about Saudi Arabia, and I confess to my shame, I did not know that there is currently awful, awful sectarian strife within the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia between the ruling Sunni class and the minority Shia. These are all Muslims, right? I mean, they're, you would think from my perspective over here in America that they're playing for the same team. But because they understand the history of Islam differently, descendants of the Prophet, etc., they are willing to kill each other. And the point that's made by the documentary is that this division is deliberate on the part of the ruling class to maintain power. Okay, I don't want to get too deep in the weeds about that. The point is, what I meant to say is that this inclination to separate the world into us and them, which is made fun of in the story about the man on the desert island that I told you about, was at one time an aspect of our human nature that enhanced our survival, and now it threatens our survival. So collaboration is really the way to go. And the internet, I'm not going to talk about, you know, the circumstances that led to it being here. I'm just glad it is here because it really facilitates in a very important way this ability to, rather than separate the world into us and them, but to minimize and eliminate the them, increase the us, and work with these people. Offer your skills. If you have skills, if you have abilities, there is someone else out there that needs them. It doesn't matter what team they play. We're all on the same team. We're all here to generate increase in our lives, to maximize the quality of our life, to increase our liberty, to increase our freedom. I'm being a little bit polemical now. In fact, there's a good argument to state that this is not the case, but this is the world that I want to live in, and I suspect if you're listening to this, this is the world you want to live in also. And this is what Liberty Freelance is all about. So if you were to go there and set up a profile, say that you have few skills, great. You can learn new skills, and I'm going to be adding educational content, and that's really sort of what's going on in this podcast too. Is offering an entree into this world where you don't need to rely on someone else for your livelihood. You can make it yourself. Okay? I'm not selling you fish. I'm teaching you to fish. I hope. That's the point of all of this. So now I want to talk about a question that I got from one of my contacts. Her name is Yashika, or Yashika. And I she's from New Delhi, and I apologize if I'm butchering your name, Yashika, but she asked a question that I get a lot, and that is, what is the scope of medical communications, is what she asked. I mean, very often I need to explain to people, I said, what do you do? I said, I do medical communications, and people kind of politely nod their head and say, yeah, as if they know what that is, but I have no easy way to sort of explain. I had no easy way to explain what it is, but I will explain as succinctly as I can. Essentially, what medical communications is for me is a species of translation. It is translating things that are complex into things that are easy. Now, this happens in a lot of fields. The field that I am most familiar with, because it's where I received my knowledge, experience, and training, is in the medical field and also the scientific field. So I call myself a medical communications company. And sometimes this translation that I do is literal translation, because I deal with documents that are written in Brazilian Portuguese, and I literally translate them into English. But it is not only literal translation, it is also figurative translation. In other words, that these documents need to be made into a form that people can understand. Now, it turns out that the second part of the translation process that I need to do is not always making these things easy, because when you write for an academic audience, you don't necessarily have to make the concepts easy. You presume a certain level of comprehension already on the part of the people who are reading, because after all, it is made for them. But a lot of what you guys do who are listening to this is you figuratively translate complex medical and scientific information, data, into a form that can be consumed by people who are not specialists. And this can be subcategorized, I'm answering your question now, Yashika, into three broad categories that I could come up with off the top of my head, and there are perhaps others. One is, one form of medical communications is informative. In other words, to inform generally a general audience about topics in the medical and or scientific world. And this is the province generally of what the people who do this tend to refer to themselves as journalists. And there are freelance journalists. There are also journalists who are paid by the media outlets that they work for. And that's all very well and good, but we're going to find out that many of these are branching out and becoming independent actors. I learned yesterday, for example, a thinker, writer, blogger, he's been a lot of things over the course of his life, Andrew Sullivan, who had recently been with New York and left, New York Magazine, left and now is truly getting paid because he's hooked up with another platform which has allowed him to disseminate his stuff, and he's already making a whole lot of money because subscribers pay him a very small amount of money every month, but he has thousands of subscribers, and Andrew is doing well. Well, he does sort of social and political stuff, but there isn't any reason why a freelance journalist can't do this in their area of expertise, be it science or medicine. The next big broad category of medical communications is what I would call promotional. Now, there are institutions out there who are medical and or scientific in their orientation, or this is their reason for being, and they need to advertise themselves to the public. And there's no reason why they should be embarrassed about this. Advertising is the way that you let the public know who you are.
Right.
I took a sip of coffee right there. If I'm going to continue speaking to you in English, I'm going to have to drink coffee, folks. That's just the way it is. So there are medical communicators who work for hospitals and other large institutions, conveying the message, translating the complex message that these institutions are telling the world into language that lay people can understand. And this is much harder than it sounds, but it is a skill you can learn, and if you stick with me, I'm going to teach you how to do it. And then finally, the third category that I was able to come up with just off the top of my head, broadly speaking, in medical communications, and this is the last part of your question, Yashika, is regulatory writing. Now, as many of you know, to move a drug which has been developed through the process of research and development to the market, in other words, to a state where a pharmaceutical company can sell it such that it can treat, diagnose, or cure disease, it must go through a very, very extensive regulatory process. And there is a specific body, a huge specific body of writing that must accompany this effort, and that's called regulatory writing. Full disclosure, I don't do regulatory writing. I don't know how to do regulatory writing. From my perspective, I'm not sure that I would get much satisfaction from doing this kind of writing, but the people who do regulatory writing do indeed get a fair amount of satisfaction, and this goes to include money, so you can get money doing this. So basically, the elevator answer to what I do is that I tell people that I translate complex concepts into easy concepts. And that is more or less the answer to your question, and I hope that did it. Folks, please ask in the comments section if you have any questions to me or hit me up on LinkedIn. That's how Yashika got this question to me. I'd be happy to answer it. So I did just get back from Nantucket. Had a terrific week there. I won't say that we had terrific weather the whole time. Nantucket never has terrific weather the whole time. I once spent a long weekend there with some classmates of mine from medical school. We were still in medical school at the time. After the third bleak, rainy, foggy day, one of my friends said to me, he said, Why do people come here? And there are a lot of reasons why people go to Nantucket, and I won't get into that right now. But I just want to tell you some observations. If you go into any store on Nantucket now and ask how the summer is going, you will get the same answer. People say things are going great. Our products are flying off the shelves. We're having a great summer. The truth is obvious to anyone who can actually look, has eyes, and can observe, especially people who know what Nantucket generally looks like in August. On Main Street, the cobblestone, quaint, and in fact quite beautiful avenue that runs down the center of town in Nantucket, there is one very large retail space that traditionally, from the time that I was very young until not so far away in the recent past, was the home of the Nantucket Looms, which was a wonderful store where there was actually literally looms in there making things out of wool. Beautiful store, and it had been other things as well over the course of time. I believe that it might have been the home of the Nantucket Emporium as well. That very large space on Main Street is empty. And this is August, and there is no retail space in there. I don't know what was in there, but the place is gone, okay? And restaurants that are open are having only outdoor seating. I'm not sure what the indoor sort of situation is. This is an island that lives and, God forbid, dies on the strength of the tourism season. And as long as tourists are still going there, Nantucket's going to do fine. But Nantucket's having a problem. So, unfortunately, an island can't work on the internet. But you know what? Nantucket finds a way. Nantucket found a way to it is constantly reinventing itself and constantly figuring out a way to prosper. They did so before the whaling industry. They found out after the whaling industry went bust, they created themselves into a tourist place, and they will figure out a way out of this. What I'm trying to help you with here, folks, is a way to help you wherever you are. If you had been in an industry, if your income relied on someone else to pay your salary, be it brick and mortar, or even if it be virtual, it is increasingly the case that you cannot rely. I mean, this is what another gift that COVID has given us. You cannot rely on the world to give you a job. Really, you need to go out and get it yourself. And the capacity, your capacity to increase your pool of human capital, your skills, knowledge, and maybe even your experience has never been greater. You can learn how to be a translator, a communicator, not just of languages, but of concepts from complex to simpler. Say necessarily simple, but you can learn how to do this, and I am going to help you do this. I'm going to teach you how to do it. There is a quote that's ascribed to Einstein, and I hope he said it. And I'm going to paraphrase it now, because A, I'm not sure Einstein really said it, and B, I'm not really sure what this quote is. But he said that every concept should be made as easy as possible, but no easier, right? So things can be simplified to a point, but obviously there is a point beyond which things simply can't be made simpler. And finding where that point is, I think, is one of the objectives of this exercise in which we are engaged. We don't have bags of time, so I'm not going to go into great detail about it. But I ran across a blog post in a blog called Dynamic Ecology, which is the Brainchild of Jeremy Fox is his name, and he has a guest post from a guy named Kevin Lafferty at the U.S. Geologic Survey, an institution for which I have enormous respect. And what caught my eye was that it was called Help Me Redesign the Scientific Paper. I'll say that again. Help Me Redesign the Scientific Paper. And this got my attention because, as many of you know, one of my persistent, I won't call them passions, maybe a obsession, maybe best with it, a better way to put it, is that the world of scientific publishing, medical publishing, the world of academic publishing as it is not necessarily the way it ought to be. And institutions generally are slow to change. That is one of the defining aspects of institutions. The institution of academic publishing has been slow to change because inertia is a law of nature. And yet the internet has made it possible to completely disrupt the entire concept of communicating the scientific enterprise to colleagues and to the public. Dr. Lafferty's idea was called collaborative independent review, and in the context of this podcast, I don't have time to go into it. But let me just say, good for you, Kevin. I'm glad that you're thinking, that you realize that there is a way to sort of break this inertia, you know, to move the flywheel, as it will, first slowly, and then it gains momentum. It's interesting. He has he has his own doubts about this this idea of collaborative independent review, and expects that people will hate it. Though this thing was published yesterday, there's already a fair amount of comments about it, and I'll put those in the comments area. I'll put that in the show notes of the podcast. I want to encourage you also to think outside the box and to think of, you know, the way that those of you who are already in this this field, just because medical and scientific papers are created and published the way they are, we deal with the publishing end. Dr. Lafferty is interested in the way that that science is performed, the way that papers are written, really from the very earliest stages of planning papers, conducting research, and then disseminating the data. And that's, I think that's all terrific, and that needs to continue. And that is the project of these many such projects. Experiments are already ongoing. Lafferty actually reminded me of the name of an outfit that I had forgotten in a previous podcast, and I invite you all to go back and listen to these previous podcasts. It was called F as in Frank 1000. F1000 Research is an open, I won't call it open access, but it is one of these post-publication peer review. Woo! I had to really dig deep. Folks, I clearly have not drunk enough coffee. Post-publication peer review journals in which articles are published and then they are subject to criticism. And I think in the internet world, there is absolutely no reason why this type of publishing should not become the rule rather than, sadly, the exception, which it is right now. Folks, if you enjoyed what you heard today, I hope that you will give us a 5-star review on whatever platform you're listening to, share the show, and go to libertyfreelance.com. make a profile, avail yourself of the content that's there. There is more content coming. This is a promise. And also my promise to you is that we will be here next week. And until next Tuesday, I hope that you'll be good to yourselves and to each other. And I will talk to you soon.